Really quickly, a note about our schedule going forward. One of the reasons we blitzed through season one and season two is to get us to this point right here, where hopefully, if we've done our math right and we've read the Adult Swim tea leaves correctly, we can do one episode for season three each week and arrive right at the point that season four premieres in November. Now, that's based on the assumption that Rick and Morty Season 4 will debut the week after Adult Swim Fest, where they'll have an exclusive premiere of the first episode. Adult Swim Fest is in November on the 15th and 16th. By the way, tickets still available. Link in the show notes. If that's wrong, then we're wrong. There might be an awkward stretch where it comes out a week or two early or late, but we'll manage it somehow. We'll throw in a feedback episode or top five Rick and Morty highlights. We'll do something with it. Point is that we're now serving as the officially unofficial countdown to Rick and Morty Season 4. Probably should have said this at the end of Season 2, but when you're recording two of these a day for a couple weeks in advance, you kind of forget a few things. One of the cool things about slowing down a bit is that we're adding some new voices to the podcast. In the weeks ahead, we'll have Jonah Ray, one of the resident riffers of the Netflix Mystery Science Theater 3000 revival, Red vs. Blue's own Gustavo Cerola, TV critic extraordinaire Alan Sepinwall, just to name a few. It's like when summer joins an adventure. It just kicks things up into higher notch gears. And we've only booked summers. There's no Jerrys. No Jerrys allowed in the podcast. It's all summers. So just so everyone's clear on it, we're down to one episode a week leading up to season four. We got some super cool guests joining to share their love of Rick and Morty with us all. Probably going to have some news and updates, especially as we get closer to the season four air date, and maybe some other fun surprises along the way. And of course, maybe fun surprises, all subjective terms, not applicable to all dimensions.
Welcome to Pickle Me This, the officially unofficial podcast for Rick and Morty on Cartoon Network's Adult Swim. I'm your host, Jim.
And I'm Aaron.
You can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Today we're covering Season 3, Episode 1, The Rickshank Rickdemption. Here's Aaron with the recap.
Rick is still in Federation custody as a result of him turning himself in last season. The feds haven't been idle. They've been busy pumping Rick's brain for all the many powerful secrets it contains, utilizing sophisticated technology that is slowly melting his mind. The Council of Ricks has been alerted to this potential breach of security and have dispatched a highly trained team of Ricks to assimilate him while in Federation's hands, which means exactly one thing. Rick has everyone where he wants them. With the quote-unquote help of Summer and Morty, Rick escapes prison, teleports the Citadel of Ricks inside a Federation stronghold, destroys the galactic economy, and exiles Jerry from the Smith family, all to place him closer to his ultimate goal, to get his hands on the discontinued McNugget Szechuan sauce from McDonald's promotional tie-in of the 1998 animated movie Mulan. Jim, what did you think of the Rickshank Redemption?
Are you speaking Krombopulous Michael here?
Just saying that almost shanked me. Like, I got a verbal shanking just right to my throat.
I thought it was great. Like, this is a way to start off a season, man. You have this two-parter, very, very like Star Trek Next Generation style. I know you're a big fan.
I am.
The two-parter that spans the gap of the season break really gets you prepared. And I think ultimately, like, more importantly, gives them time to really figure out how the hell they're going to get themselves out of the situation they wrote themselves into.
Yeah.
And it's great here because, like, right up front at the beginning, you think, oh, shit, they didn't figure this out and they just skipped it. Like, they're really fucking with the audience for a good 2 minutes at the beginning, mm-hmm. telling us how great the adventure was. But it doesn't compare to being at Shoney's with his family. And then it all turns out to be bullshit. It's so good. It's so good.
Yeah, the one thing you get in these commentaries is the guys and gals writing this just really sweat and are fearful that they will not, live up to the expectations set by previous seasons. And, you see an episode like this and it's like, you just see all the sweat. Like, there's so, like, the central idea itself is clever enough to sustain, like, a prestige drama, right? Mm-hmm. Like this is intricate plotting worthy of the best you see on television. And then just a multiple layered nuanced jokes and just, you know, not just like the big stuff, but like the dead flies that like Summer is just trying to like as a joke, like this is something. Turns out that's his security system. It's so fucking brilliant.
And Jerry gets blamed for having moved them, even though it was Summer.
Like, yeah.
It's all good.
And there's this stuff in the background where it's like, you know, casually, oh, right there between your memories of where you were on 9/11 and your favorite sports blooper. And that the sports blooper plays out in real time. And then you see Rick having like, oh shit, Rick's having a human reaction to 9/11, but you can overhear him just ranting and raving about the political ramifications of it. It's great. You know, him rapidly taking commandeering people's bodies and just taking time to regret not being able to test drive an alien dick. It succeeds in both ways, both big and broad and very narrow and specific. And it is the perfect, and you can't discuss this episode without the like context around it, which is people were hounding Dan night and day about when Rick and Morty was going to be released. And then on one April Fool's Day, he just picked one of this out of the sea of Twitter trolls and said, well, what if it's today, huh? How about, is that soon enough? And they released it as a anti-April Fool's joke.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to get too far into the commentary talk, but it seemed like this was an Adult Swim idea.
Yeah.
The Dan was maybe against, but then he realized later, oh, actually, that was a great idea.
And it did seem to, like, kick everyone into overdrive. Like, this show was always popular, but, like, season three, it definitely took the leap into the stratosphere. And that part of this marketing, which is just like this fully formed thing, it's released, you can watch it now, and now who knows when you get another hit, just had people, you know, riot. Like, literally by the end of this sequence of marketing, it led to rioting in McDonald's over Szechuan sauce in real life. Like, that's how fucking crazy passions got over the show.
Yeah, and the Szechuan came back because of it.
Yeah to everyone's chagrin. Shall we talk about this episode, because there's a lot to unpack? Where do you want to begin with, Jim?
I mean, I could begin at the beginning. I really liked what they were doing here, kind of fucking with the audience. Not only in the idea that like they wouldn't have shown, you know, the epic escape, but that it was so epic, it was so amazing.
Yeah.
And yet here we are sitting, drinking coffee and eating pancakes, which is the exact opposite of exciting. I really love that they kind of start out with that really just jab at the audience.
And I got to say, I remember vividly thinking that, like, I was doing the mental math, like, this is horseshit. But this show has got enough trolley DNA and big enough balls that I'm actually, and as I was processing that, then Jerry gets up and folds himself, you know, six times or whatever. But yeah, like, because that's the thing. This show is kind of like the same way Game of Thrones until the very end. Every time someone was near death, it was a scary experience. Like, Rick and Morty's the type of show that just might, you know what? Fuck it. It was amazing. Now we're going to go on and do the next thing. And I think they could get away with it.
Yeah, I think so. But it would have disappointed a lot of people as well. And then Nathan Fillion shows up.
Right.
And I really love Nathan Fillion's acting in this. He does a great Rick impression later in the episode.
Yeah. Like when Nathan Fillion opens his mouth, quote, so to speak, in this episode, my you know, mandibles did that kind of like excited chittering, because it's just like, God damn, every time he pops up in something I love, it's a nice occasion.
And the introduction scene where he sits down with Rick is hilarious to me. The concept that not only could Rick manifest these butts in this coffee cup, but that he would, like, he's the smartest being in the universe, and he's playing this ridiculous joke on this guy.
And also, I think there's part of it, and
it's just so juvenile.
I love it. Part of it in the Nathan Fillion insect's mind has got to be like, and he's laughing at it. Is this actually straight up, or is this part of the psychological warfare that he's
good
doing?
Question.
Yeah, it's because, you know, like, is he this simple minded on a fart joke, or is this some kind of next level gamesmanship he's trying?
I think everything we've seen from Rick tells us that he loves a good crude juvenile joke.
Right.
Like, I mean, he's ripping farts left and right at the end as punchlines, you know.
Right. And the fact that people want to, like, that uses dizzying intellect as a way to try to skewer him, and like, come now, Rick, I thought you were Like, yeah, you thought. Oh, you thought, did you? Well, here's another but.
That'll teach you a thing.
Yeah, beefing right in your face. I'm sure that, yes, he does have the juvenile sense of humor, and it's just like a side effect that it's also like weapons-grade psychological warfare.
Right. And I think the art is really cool in this, too, because when we're in this brainalyzer construct kind of thing, we get sort of a neural network, very brainy looking sky in the background. I thought that was a nice touch.
Yeah.
Just kind of the way that everything, you know, folds in and out of space. Very inventive, very creative.
Yeah. Probably kept the animators pulling their hair out alongside the writer's room. I thought it was some interesting family dynamics that were kind of on display. It seems to me that, like, in the absence of Rick, what they were suggesting is that Beth has transferred this kind of like excuse making or caretaking over to Jerry, because the kids are kind of like being critical of like this bullshit scenario that everyone's found them in. And, you know, Beth is like, well, your father's pulling down a 6-2-able figure salary. Even though no one knows what he does, like, it feels like that she, the same way that she wouldn't hear of anyone talking bad about Rick, she's kind of doing that with Jerry.
Mm-hmm.
Is that kind of like,
And then it immediately switches back when Rick shows back up, right?
Yeah. Is that like some kind of like learned behavior that she saw with her dynamic between her dad and her mom? Or like, my
only reading on it is that she's back under Rick's spell. Like, Rick, she's blinded by the love for her father to see sort of how destructive Rick has been on the family. And when he's back in her life, that just takes over again. It's a pattern she falls back into.
Well, I mean, you're not wrong. It does seem like it's a pattern, as we discussed, but there's also, like, you know, I don't think she's a fully irrational being, because Rick engineered the situation precisely to make him look like fucking John McClane at the end of a Die Hard movie. Mm-hmm. Like, at the end of the Die Hard movie, where his wife, who has a million reasons to divorce him because John McClane is kind of a fucking asshole, gets moony-eyed and moist because, you know, he just single-handedly took down a terrorist regime, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, like, you know, like the mother-in-law flying in from the screen being like, why are you taking this guy back? Well, he's not in that movie. She is in this particular show in the form of Jerry. He comes flying in like, your dad might have single-handedly drove off these alien oppressors, but he's back and I'm putting my foot down. He just looks like such an asshole.
In this case, it's like if there was Szechuan sauce in the safe in Die Hard.
Yeah.
And it turns out Bruce Willis was actually just after that.
Yeah. Yeah. He had engineered the entire situation with Hans and murdered all these people.
So they would open the safe and he could get the sauce.
Right. As he's being hailed as a hero. I mean, and that's the way that Rick plays the psychology, where, like, he is the model citizen when Jerry, you know, like, I'm putting my foot down. He's like, oh, well, you guys seem like you have to. It's so fucking snake in the grass, man.
Yeah.
And then genuinely horrifying, the stuff he says at the end, you know, about how all of this, like, it starts off horrifying that I've displaced your father because he crossed me. And I also destroyed the government of the universe. And I also destroyed the anti-government of the universe. And that's pretty horrifying, but then it's all about the Szechuan sauce.
It is, yeah.
Although, again, is this literally true? Because this is a comedy cartoon, right?
Right, and it's also during a rant where he says, nine more seasons, Morty, nine more seasons, 97 years. And I did the math, and I'm like, man, you thought a 2-year break between seasons was bad.
Yeah.
9 seasons and 97 years.
They'll be making this
better
in the quadcentennial of the United States being celebrated.
Right. Who knows, really? Like, I don't think it's all about the sauce. I don't think Rick cares that much about the sauce, though I do think he would try and separate Jerry from this family, because he clearly cares far more about his daughter and his grandchildren than he does Jerry.
See, I think the Szechuan sauce is a cover story.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, I can't be real because I just tried that the end of last season and it led to my entire life being upended. So this is some kind of fucked up thing I can tell as a cover story, so I don't have to deal with the fact that I love my family.
Yeah, that's a good point.
While we're on the subject of Rick loving his family, a perennial topic is, you know, like, how genuine is this, how surface level, how is it different from other Ricks? So we ordinarily we would say we got a lot of information into Rick's inner workings, but it was all presented as if it was a false memory and an engineered escape plan from Rick. What of, you know, a different, you know, infinite Ricks versus a different kind of Rick, you know, versus the love he has for his daughter and family? How much of that stuff is actual, real, the story of the portal gun? How much of it is actually real and how much of it is completely made up? Because I don't think it's 100% made up.
No?
Well, I mean, doesn't it stand to reason there has to be a, like, not all Ricks will invent portal gun technology simultaneously? Mm-hmm. So, like, that element of, like, you know, this slightly punk rock mullet-wearing Rick coming back and explaining the fact that you're about to invent Portal Gun, but we've done it 5 minutes sooner. Like, that stuff seems real.
I suppose it could be. I really don't have a way to tell.
Oh, I was just thinking that because, like, if you go that thought experiment of, like, it seems reasonably true that, like, if an infinite number of Ricks invent portal gun, they're going to do it on some kind of, like, you know, bell curve of, of when they do it. And then they're like, the ones that invented first would start reconnecting. The Ricks that refuse the call to this particular type of adventure, it does feel like the other Ricks are vindictive enough that they're like, well, this doesn't fit into our idea of what a Rick is, so we should try to sterilize it or something. So I'm like, yeah, I'm trying to, like, what is this? What is there anything that we can, like, put together everything else we know about the universe to say?
Yeah. So in an infinite series of Ricks,
yeah,
wouldn't it stand to reason that the Ricks who are going around blowing up the Ricks who don't invent the portal gun technology or won't invent it? Would be doing that forever.
Do they have, like, some kind of prime directive where it's like they can only contact a Rick when he's 15 minutes away from, because you're right, the bad end of that bell curve is pretty fucking far out. Like, maybe some Ricks,
it's all the way out.
Yeah, they, like, they live their natural life and die without inventing the portal gun.
Yeah, I would assume.
They're like Doc Brown.
The vast majority of them probably do.
Yeah, like they might have had the idea for the flux capacitor in 1955, but...
Yeah, they just never... They hit their head on the toilet and died.
That's right. Like, yeah, there's an infinite number of dead Doc Browns on the toilet. I wish we had an economist on that I could... Because I actually would like to know what the impact of changing... Like, if you could act, like, forget about the relative possibility. If there's some way you could take, like, the U.S. dollar and change it to zero at some place that it mattered, like, how long would it take to undo that devastation? Because I read this book.
We're about to find out with Brexit.
Are we?
Yeah. The no-deal Brexit. That'll change the pound to zero.
To zero? Okay. All right. Well, then we'll see that experience. Because I've always wondered. I mean, it's been the plot of some... It wasn't that the plot of The Last Batman. I know it was a Tom Probably. Clancy novel where, like, essentially they deleted the stock exchange or bollocksed up the records so no one could tell what trades actually happened. And
yeah, it's like a Mr. Robot thing, right?
Yeah, and and it's like one of those things, it's like, what does that actually do? Because, you know, money is not as fictional as people want to make it. It represents something.
Sure.
But on the other hand, you can make it all go away, and, like, the factories and infrastructure and the labor force, all that stuff remains impacted. But it seems like...
Yeah, I really think it's the greed of the Federation that undoes them in this episode. Because, like, you're right. When they change it to zero, they still have everything they had before. They simply don't have a good way to value it, right? And so people could continue to do things the way they've done before and just have this agreement that they're working upon. But they don't, because they're greedy. Like, who's paying me for this? If nobody's paying me, I'm not doing it. Fuck it.
There's a reprise of the end of the... Look Who's Purging Now, kind of, you know, I'll do that, but for more.
And then also their greed leads them in the first place to let Rick Sanchez escape. If they keep him in solitary, if they don't want his portal gun if they're not so greedy that they need to get it from him and take him out and put him in the brainalyzer, none of this happens.
Right.
So really it's the greed that undoes them.
I like how in lieu of a stable galactic currency, everyone picks pants as the going currency. Yeah, who controls the pants controls the universe.
Which is rough, too, because they're stealing the pants off of people who only have one joint in their legs.
Ooh.
I don't know if pants tailored for humans work with the Federation.
Yeah, and how do you value like a three-leg pant versus a two-leg or a one-leg or, mm-hmm. you know, if what if a species rolls around on a ball? They just wear like giant skirts.
Yeah, not pants.
Are skirts like the dimes to the pants dollar?
Like the pennies, nobody uses them, but yeah. They still exist for some reason.
Yeah, well, obviously the people with the giant pile, sitting on the giant piles of pants will sort this out because, you know, yeah. they
have an incentive to.
And then they're a higher station of life because they're literally sitting on a giant pile of pants. You know,
higher obviously off the ground.
That's just not yeah. some random luck that occurred. They're robber barons of pants and they should be listened to.
I do love when all hell breaks loose in the society that apparently Mr. Goldenfold has been leading a yeah. literal underground rebellion.
Yeah, yes.
Against the Federation the whole time.
Yeah, I love that of everyone in town, Mr. Goldenfold is the he's the Braveheart
uh-huh.
of humanity. he's the president from Independence Day. He's amazing.
Oh, and the other thing with this
That's
escape.
Canon. He's a revolutionary fighter. Revolutionary war hero.
I mean, certainly in that universe, that version of Mr. Goldenfold.
Yeah, yeah.
The other thing I want to talk about is Rick's body. Rick's body is dead. His original body is murdered by him.
And they have this throwaway line of like, your insect mind is not big enough to hold my entire intellect. So like, and they pay that joke off immediately with him saying, oh, God damn it. Because he forgot his 6 years of improv training. Uh-huh. And he said, I forgot how to improvise. I thought that was a really wild, hard sci-fi concept that I wish it was taken a little bit more seriously. Because, mm-hmm. like, man, that's like a fucking Ray Bradbury short novel. Like, hey, you can get in, uploaded into this robot body, but oh, it's like when you get a new iPhone or you get a new phone and it's the new one's got less capacity than the old one. It's like, what are you going to lose? We can only hold 75% of you, man. Like, here's your choices. Your child's birth, your college degree. Like, I would love to see that. You know, with Rick, it's just a throwaway. His improv classes.
And that's the thing. Like, so many of these concepts that Rick and Morty introduces and meditates on for a second are, like, throwaway things, right? But they're also things that could be expanded into an entire episode because they're so meaty. And it's one of the things I love about Rick and Morty, how it combines all of these different concepts into whatever form they want it to take.
Finally, we've got a stinger that seems like it's one of those that is moving the myth arc forward, where we see that Bird Person, last feared murdered at his own sham wedding to Tammy, has actually been reconstructed by Tammy and a team of Federation scientists into the resurrected Phoenix Person.
Yeah.
I like this idea. I like the idea of Rick having to have a face-off with one of his former friends, like that, you know, kind of like a Pin Sylvester moment that actually is earned, you know, because like in the parasite where they're killing all the parasites and then it came down to Pin Sylvester and he's like, I can't pull wow. the trigger. You know, it's like, uh-huh. I actually have that, but that's just a joke because we didn't know Pin Sylvester. Pin Sylvester is just a blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Him having to go against Bird Person would be that, but it wouldn't be a joke.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to see how the Rick and Morty team can make that funny. Because, like, they got these situations that seem like there's just so much pathos. And shit, they put this family through a divorce and it's still been funny. You know, but funny in a sad, divorcey kind of way.
And it's kind of a big, like, that wedding is a big moment in Rick Sanchez's life, right?
Yeah.
Because we talked a little bit about how that's kind of him trying to open up in that moment. And this is like, could potentially be scarring with the way that all turned out.
Right.
You know, more scars on top of the scars.
Right.
Yeah, to have a showdown with him, I wonder what form that would take. Would it be this emotional thing where he has to make tough decisions, or would he simply be so calloused at this point that it wouldn't matter?
Well, it'd be interesting. Here's, after you said that, the thing that now I'm thinking would be interesting is that if he does callously or cold-bloodedly kill Bird Person, it would be a stark contrast to how he feels about Morty, because we've seen him sacrifice himself to save Morty's life and then like be at peace with that decision. So that would like, it would definitely give, you know, a little bit more juice to the like Rick really, really cares on some like non-vestigal level, because you know, presumably, you know, it's his best friend, takes him out without question, but he hesitates with his family. And I also think, just on that topic, that this episode is also interesting in that the Council of Rick's opinion on Rick is kind of like what we've emerged in his podcast, that he is un-Rick-like in his affection for his grandkids. Mm-hmm. But it's also hard to rationalize that with the, you know, Hunger Games summer, the Cronenberg family too, that like,
right.
Is it literally just Morty? That doesn't seem right.
No, I mean, I think it's an evolution across the three seasons of this show.
That's true, because he's not the same. He's changing as a person as well.
And Summer's gotten some characterization, you know. She's become a character in her own right, one that Rick cares about as well.
Yeah, I mean, she's the one that... That's another interesting aspect, is that it seemed like that Summer was the one that was true blue for Rick, but then Morty reveals at the end that, like, nah, I was just trying to protect you. Like, mm-hmm. I was always pro Rick as well, but, like, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, it's like seeing an eldritch god. it's all fun and games till your sanity melts away, till your minds are blown.
Yeah, Morty breaks in this episode, man. That plot, like, where Morty has to be incredibly stupid, or they have to believe that he's incredibly stupid.
Yeah.
And the Rick and Summer think so. And obviously we know that Morty didn't see the note, based on his tone. He tries to kill Rick. It's not the first time he's tried to kill Rick.
Yeah.
He did it in Look Who's Purging. Or
well, I said, this does seem
sort
like
of intimated that he would.
Yeah.
This is a breaking point for Morty.
Or just then, evidence of further fracturing. Because, yeah, like, the Look Who's Purging was definitely that, like, in retrospect, a breaking point. And this is just, you know, it makes you wonder, how next level is Rick? Was this a blind spot of Rick's, or did Rick count on Morty's newfound murderous rage to be provoked into using this fake pistol on him?
Right.
I mean, they didn't. That's not in the episode.
No, it's not. And I think he assumed he saw the note, because he says, good one.
After this short break, we'll have an interview with Mystery Science Theater 3000's Jonah Ray about his connection to Rick and Morty as he tells a cautionary tale about electric scooter rentals. We'll be right back.
Head bent over. Yeah. Raise the posterior.
Sing it with me now.
Head bent over.
Yeah.
Raise the posterior.
All right.
Head bent over.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering The Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwais is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
You probably know Jonah as one of the hosts of either the Nerdist or Meltdown podcast, and as the only fully human riffer on Mystery Science Theater 3000's revival on Netflix, or perhaps his newest project, You Can't Call Me Al, a Weird Al cover album. It's in its second printing because the first one is sold out. You can properly adore him on Twitter at Jonah Ray. Jonah, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, guys. It's an honor to be here. And by here, I mean not anywhere near you guys, in a completely different sound booth. I don't know how many miles away from... I don't even think you guys are in the same room.
I'm thousands of miles away from Aaron. At least emotionally.
Yeah. Like, one of the ways we like to kind of get things started is ask you about your personal experience with Rick and Morty. Like, how'd you get turned on to it? Were you like a day one watcher? Did the buzz get to you?
I, I mean, I know everyone that works on it. So I guess you could say my first the first thing I knew about Rick and Morty was probably Doc and Marty, or even before that, House of Cosby's. I was an avid Channel 101 attendee back in the day when they first started. I remember going to the second one, which was at a Thai restaurant in Vine in Hollywood. And then I remember checking in every once in a while, going almost every month, and then seeing House of Cosby's, I think, was Roiland's first thing that I saw that really got me interested in his work. And then right around the time he did Doc and Marty, me and my friends were trying to think of a cartoon about Doc and Marty living in a sad apartment together where nothing really worked out in the end. And the Libyans lived upstairs from them and were always having parties. And Marty always was just right about to send in that demo tape to the major labels,
right?
And never did. But yeah. So I mean, I then the people, you know, Justin and Dan and Mike Chilean. You know, it's I was very aware of the development of this show and very excited for it because I like all those guys. And. And I got to go to the premiere of the first episode at CineSpace when they did that. And I remember just kind of being blown away by, I knew I was going to like it, but I didn't know it was going to be that good, like that solid and that amazing. And that, like that with, you know, with the type of people working on it with, and this is a long answer to your question. I apologize.
Hey, well, we get someone in on day zero. We're going to stand back and give them room.
But just the stuff that we're, you know, Roiland is so absurd, and Dan is so loves to ground things and make things truly make sense as much as possible. And then, you know, early on you had, you know, Chilean, who's such a student of animation and animation jokes, which is, you know, such a visual, it's another level of creating comedy. And to have all these people kind of coming in on it, and I'm sure I'm, you know, forgetting a ton of names that had, like, you know, a ton of stuff to do with it, but those were the guys I knew before watching it, and just seeing how it was just a combination of all kinds of great comedy slamming into each other.
So after seeing, you know, what Rick and Morty became as it sort of progressed through the first three seasons.
I didn't expect that. Like, I knew it was good, but a lot of shows are good.
Right.
But what's happened to Rick and Morty is insane.
What is it about Rick and Morty that draws you to it?
I mean, it's great jokes, great animation, great animation sequences, you know, great stories. It's just like a well-rounded show, like I said. It's, you know, but it's... It's one of those things where I would hope that people would like it, but I could have never assumed or predicted like that it would be, you know, just bros with their you're getting a call. Should I just decline it? I'll just decline it. All right. Decline.
Nice. Nice.
But yeah, I would have never assumed that I would have been in a like, you know, in the middle of the country seeing like a truck with, you know, Rick and Morty airbrushed on the back tailgate, you know.
Right.
It's just a good solid show.
With your kind of like personal experience with the creators and whatnot, you might what is your like favorite episode? Is it like just like something you purely enjoy, or is like, oh, that's so Justin, or what is your favorite episode and why?
I mean, there was one that Mikhail did a voice on. I think it was the Thunderdome, Beyond Thunderdome kind of one.
The Armathy.
You know what? And the one thing I think about when I think about Rick and Morty, and I think about the brilliance of it, that encapsulates everything I like about it, is I think it's in the pilot, and it's and I haven't seen it since it aired. But there's a moment where like a molecule speeds through the evolution process.
Mm. Oh yeah, yeah,
and,
yeah.
And gains sentience. Gains, like, you know, thought and a soul almost in front of you. But the lifespan is so accelerated that it just immediately dies.
Yeah, how horrifying
that
is.
This, Yeah, exactly. And it's this thing that's like really, it really just shows, it's like funny because it's fast paced. It's the animation of it is insane. Just this, that's a lot of work to do to show like a, something kind of, you know, developing while everyone's running at the same time. And then to have it die, and then to just have that thing of like this moment of I'm alive and then you die. And that is just, it's all my favorite things of just heart and soul and animation and nihilism of Rick and Morty that I really do enjoy.
We noticed that when we were kind of, because I was familiar with your work on like Mystery Science Theater and some of your podcasts, but we did some digging and we saw that you're like a punk rocker in your soul from Hawaii. And wondering with regard to your personal musical expertise and taste, what do you think of the music on Rick and Morty? And do you have like a favorite song from the show?
I mean, any song from the show that just sounds like it's Justin making it up in the booth is usually the stuff I enjoy the most. Like the TV show episodes,
Getting Swifty.
Yeah. It's funny though. I find myself always going to. I listen to the Allie Gertz Sad Dance Songs album a lot, where she does a bunch of Rick and Morty songs that she made up, which is kind of like what I did with that Weird Al thing, where she just kind of like was inspired by the show and made songs about it.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. You have an album that has either just come out or is about to come out. Called You Can't Call Me Out.
Yeah, it just came out a couple weeks ago. Yeah, You Can't Call Me Out. It's just, I was bored, and I like making little punk tunes, and I don't like writing lyrics because I always end up revealing truths about myself that I don't really want to know. And so I just, use lyrics I know, and usually those are Al lyrics. And so I just, recorded it with my friends from the band Fiddlar and Blood Brothers, and we just kind of and then Asian Man Records, one of my favorite punk labels, like put it out on vinyl. And yeah, it was just like a real kind of fun, fluky thing to do. And people seem to enjoy it somewhat. Some people are confused by it, which is also just as satisfying.
It's funny because when Jim told me about the project, I'm like, a Weird Al cover? What the? And then when I heard like Welcome to Amish Paradise, I'm like, I get it. You're doing to his work kind of what he did with his polka. Like,
it's like the Green Day, the indie punk kind of. The video has almost like a Beastie Boys Fight for Your Right kind of vibe to it, like house party thing.
Thanks. Yeah. I was just trying to think. I came up with that within like a day or two. And there's a lot of people like from the Channel 101 scene that were in the video. And that was just one of those things. I'm like, oh, I should make a video. How can I make a really simple video? And so a bunch of us piled into Dave Lyons' house, who was, an old school Channel 101 guy who did Yacht Rock and whatnot. And
I remember that show.
Locations manager. Yeah, he was a locations manager on Community. So it was just very much, Kate Freund was there. It was just a lot of 101ers and who are, that's the scene that's responsible for Rick and Morty being a thing. So it was kind of, tangentially, it still works on this podcast.
It seems to me that when I was thinking about this, there's a lot of parallels between like what Rick and Morty does and like what you guys do on Mystery Science Theater 3000 with, you've got this nostalgia towards tropey science fiction fantasy stuff. And it feels like you guys are kind of pulling at a lot of the same threads, but at different ends, because, they're pulling from like Star Wars and Star Trek and Battlestar. And you guys are dealing with
Doctor
like,
Who a lot.
And you guys are in like the Mac and Me and Italian Hercules lane. But didn't Dan do some writing for like the revival series as well?
Yeah. He we had a bunch of guest writers on different episodes from the first season back, which is season 11. Him and Justin and I think Ryan Ridley and Tom Kaufman also contributed some jokes and stuff like that. So yeah, it's weird though, because like everything gets, all the jokes just get kind of dumped into this one file, so you don't really know who wrote what or what got into where, which is great, because then anytime you're having a conversation with someone and someone brings up a certain riff that they liked, you could go, yeah, that was probably mine.
Well, it sounds like what they, because, we've, in part of this project, we've gone through like all the behind the scenes and the commentaries. And it sounds like that's kind of the way a writer's room, or at least the ones that Dan runs and Justin runs, that's kind of how they work. That everyone kind of pitches in and it gets reduced to a stew. And sure, it's assigned to a single writer for the credit, but like, you know, they're just kind of like formalizing everybody's input and feedback. So,
yeah. I mean, like writing on a show is just it's important to just have that fun element of everyone in the room together, because, you know, comedy written by committee can be a good thing because it just everyone's trying to elevate a joke. And when you have a bunch of people with the same sense of humor trying to achieve the best version of it. And that's the thing. I'm rarely in a writer's room that where someone gets upset. Like, you know, usually it's like everyone kind of agrees. You know, sometimes someone will have an ego about something and go, no, this is a funnier joke or this is better. But for the most part, the room will always kind of, like, you know, when something happens and when something gets to a certain joke, the room will decide. You know, just they'll just feel it. They'll be like, oh, yeah, that's the best one. Because that's what everyone's going for. They're not, you know, it's a, the ego can get in the way, but at the same time, everyone has the same end result.
Sounds like you worked in the good writer's rooms, not the bad ones.
Yeah, I mean, it all kind of is set up by the boss. It can be maddening. It could be, you know, one of those things where, and I've been the boss in some rooms too, where it's you're hearing stuff and you're kind of going like, no, that's not it. And everyone's just kind of going, what do you want? You just make it then, you know, which is, you know, something that also like Dan has been pretty famous for, which is, you know, just kind of, you know, like, really just going over and over and over and over things to make sure it's as good as it can be and to his high standards, which are always pretty great.
So all this is kind of preamble. What'd you think of the Rickshank Redemption, the season opener for season 3?
I remember when I was watching it, I was kind of, when it premiered, I was confused. And I was like, this is like, they're starting the season off kind of slow, kind of emotional, which is fine by me, but I was just kind of like, man, you know, this is a highly anticipated season. You know, this is probably the most people tuning into this than the other two seasons premieres. And then once it gets to the big breakout with the amount of shit going on screen and with the amount of story that had been cleverly layered throughout, it's such a feat. Like the amount of stuff where you could just, you know, slow it down and just see how many different Ricks and bug guys and all these things are just be like, there's so much stuff happening. Like just like that, you know, that little molecule that, you know, gains life and then dies really fast. It's like there's a lot of little things going on, and the animators really knocked it out of the park with that, you know, huge end battle sequence.
Yeah, I'm constantly impressed by them.
Yeah.
The one thing that this episode taught me is if Rick is showing any emotion, he's manipulating you. He's not actually being genuine.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's crazy because you want to. The show constantly, like, you know, you start to root for Rick. And then you realize, oh, what was I doing? What a terrible idea! Why did I feel for him? It really is just a test to make sure you know you're being manipulated or you're being gaslit.
And yet, it always works too. It works on me every time. Rick shows a bit of emotion. I'm like, okay, he's finally opening up. Nah, he closes the door again. It was all simulation. He had control. He was fooling you.
Yeah, you should know. It's funny. I was watching that My Friend Dahmer movie, the one based off of that graphic novel. And when you're watching it and, you know, Jeffrey Dahmer, it's like him in high school and he starts to kind of get friends and he starts to kind of be embraced. And you kind of start to go, well, maybe they'll change history. Maybe
right.
Like you want it to be OK. And then, you know, then it's not OK. And that's the thing you got to remember. That's the same feeling with when you're watching Rick. You're like, maybe he is getting better. But the show wouldn't be the show if he was at all a good person.
We do have another 70 episodes, so
yeah,
maybe.
That's why I keep thinking that, like, you know, the people, because like at the end, I felt like I maybe got rope-a-dope, but at the end of season 2, I felt like he was making some real progress and he had a setback because, you know, he finally opened himself to friendship and love and being happy for his friend, and it turned out it was a sham wedding, and it's actually the Federations are coming to kill all of his buddies, and, you know, he has extreme, and I was wondering, it's like, you know, that's how, like, if a person was in therapy and trying to recover from something, it's like, it's not like there's this clear climb up the mountain, right? They have setbacks, and they get wounded, and they kind of retreat back to, and I just wonder if that's Well, do you have a gut feeling on this, Jonah? Is Rick's arc overall after all 100 episodes?
He doesn't talk about these things because they might reveal stuff about
him.
That's
true. That's true. What Weird Al song says it best? If Dare to be stupid.
Yeah. Precisely. You know, it's funny though. It's that thing you were saying where it's maybe at the end of season two he was starting to feel. I think about the situation when we were on the last Mystery Science Theater tour. You know, my wife and I, like, we were going city to city, and I was like, let's take these Bird or Lime scooters around town. You know, and she's like, no, she was scared. You know, she was nervous about going on them. You know, she's like, what if I fall? I'm like, you won't fall. They're really easy. They're really fun. And it's a great way to, like, see these cities that we've never been in. And, you know, we're in Nashville, she won't do it. We're in, Austin, she won't do it. And then, like, we find ourselves in St. Louis, and then she does it and it goes fine. And I was like, oh, and like, it was for me, I was kind of like, ooh, see, she'll see that her fear was unfounded and it's totally fine. And then the next stop we have in is in Memphis. And then she's like, I was like, hey, there's some Lime scooters. She's like, let's take them. I go, oh man, she's over this irrational fear that something will definitely happen that's bad. And then she crashes so hard this Lime scooter.
Terrible.
As we were like rolling up to a restaurant, something happened with the wheel. It hit something and she fell over the handlebars, landed on her chin, scraped the skin off her chin, like busted up her hand, like landed on her hip. Her hip was bruised. And it's one of those things where she ended up being right.
Your scheme was undone by the shoddy infrastructure of the Memphis sidewalks.
Exactly. Exactly. And so, like, it's like the whole thing is a self-fulfilling prophecy. So, you know, Rick says he'll be like, it's like, no, he's, you know, very nihilistic and then all for himself. And then maybe once he starts feeling it, something like that happens, like the wedding thing. And then it just only ever, you know, solidifies and calcifies his thoughts. I also like wanted to talk about some of my other favorite elements of the episode, which was the memories displayed outside of Shoney's, where like there was this thing where I was watching it and then last time he sees his wife between, I can't remember what one of them was, but the other one was watching 9/11 unfold on TV.
Yeah.
And you see him in the background though, and he looks like he's distressed. And I remember thinking like, why would he be distressed? And then I it doesn't seem like something. And then of course then you hear him in the background going, it's like, you know, he's like this is just an excuse to get us into war,
right?
Which I
right.
thought was just such a like a funny thing. Like in my head I'm like, oh, Rick really cared about what happened to this. Oh no, he's just freaking out because he knows the end result. I just thought that's one of my favorite little background elements of that episode for sure. Yeah.
And then, like, his tricksy self, it turns out the whole thing, made-up memories. Mm-hmm. Although, it's like, I have questions. Yeah. Like, is it completely made up? Is he selling the lie with an element of the truth? That's the interesting thing about the Rubik's Cube that is Rick's emotional and moral state.
Yeah. No, it's real tricky. And it's all of it. And to, like, have known, you know, Justin and Dan for so long now. It's hard not to read into every aspect of those characters.
Oh man, just as an outside viewer, I do that all the time. I listen to one commentary and I'm like, oh, Dan feels this way and Dan feels that way, and
right.
You know, I listen to a Harmontown episode and it's like, I know Dan.
Yeah.
When I've never met him.
So all those parasocial relationships will get you every time.
They really will. But as far as promotion, yeah, that You Can't Call Me Out, it's available all on the digital platforms all over the place. You know, Apple and Google and Spotify and whatnot. And then we're doing a second pressing. The first pressing of the vinyl on Asia Man Records sold out, and we're doing a second pressing of it.
Nice. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you. That's all. Oh, and if people that listen to this probably like Harmon Quest, which is on VRV.
Are you in the new season?
CISO. No, I'm not in the new season, but my show, Hidden America, which was also on CISO, is now available for free on VRV, in front of the paywall and everything.
Cool. Oh, nice.
Two seasons worth of a lot of stuff, yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah, fake travel show.
Well, Jonah Ray, thanks for taking time out to come on and gush about Rick and Morty with us. We had a lot of fun.
Yeah, thanks so much. Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Human music. I like it.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
All right, Jim, are you ready to plot to the future?
I am.
This is, of course, where we open up a portal to Dimension BM77 to access behind-the-scene details, trivia, and spoilers for future episodes. I'm going to be running out of these pretty soon. We're about to catch up to the current timeline, in which case this BM77 probably thrown into the garbage portal.
Savor it while you can, like a fine Szechuan sauce. Savor it, because it'll be gone soon.
Yeah, until the season 4 Blu-rays come out.
Mm-hmm.
What did you think about the behind-the-scenes details and ties into future plots?
Dude, I looked at the commentary list on this thing, and my brain melted.
Yeah.
Because there's a commentary. Okay, so the main commentary, you know, it's Dan, Justin, all the people... Yeah. Who work on Juan, I think is his name. And then it has John Mayer.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking, boy, that's weird. And then I look down a little bit further, and I see a commentary with none of them, and just Marilyn Manson and Courtney Love. And I was so curious at what kind of shit show it would be that I watched it.
They got they intend to have a musical commentary, and John Mayer showed up. He's like, I don't want to get in the booth.
Right. Can I do this with you guys instead?
This recording booth is not a wonderland. I don't want any part of it.
He made a good choice because that commentary with Marilyn Manson and Courtney Love is Courtney Love barely being a human being on microphone.
Okay.
For an hour, and Marilyn Manson making sex jokes and weirdly coming on to Courtney.
Yeah, that's probably on brand.
Real bad.
Oof.
Like, I don't know if they're both. Of course, they're both fucked up.
Uh huh.
Whether it's from their long history with drugs and abuse, or whether it's because that day they were fucked.
Yeah.
I don't know, but.
It's because the Starburns Industries has, instead of like a 5 gallon water cooler, they have a 5 gallon Keitel One cooler.
Okay, yeah.
Like you don't even tend to. It's like, can I get some? It's our water's 100 proof here. What do you want?
Yeah, and then when I listened to that one first, and then I went back and I was like, okay, all right, John Mayer. I'm not expecting anything from you, but actually, John Mayer turned out to be a really good commentator.
Yeah, I imagine it's about the same point in the time stream he came on the Harmontown. And I'm not sure, like, I don't remember why and how they kind of came into each other's orbit. I think they probably explained it and I've forgotten. But I thought that he was a really, you know, game and insightful and kind of funny, thoughtful podcast guest. So it didn't surprise me that his commentary track was, he added a lot.
He did, yeah.
Yeah, he was like, you know, having like a engaged, intelligent fan ask like kind of engaged, intelligent fan questions was really, really smart.
Yeah, he had one theory about the way that Rick and Morty addresses Rick's powers and this the family dynamic with those. Like when he said, like in most sitcoms, what they do is they have, I guess he compared it to like Alf. If you have where if somebody finds out about the things that are happening,
right,
there's going to be trouble.
Right. If you find out that there's an alien next door,
right,
the government's going to get involved.
Or living in the garage,
split
whatever.
His dick in half.
And Rick and Morty doesn't do that, right? The family is in on it. The family knows what's up. It's just a matter of
the neighborhood
of
can observe a UFO landing right. in the garage, and it's just like, oh, you know, it'd be like your neighbor pulling up in maybe a Lamborghini.
Uh-huh.
You know, like, yeah, people notice it, but like, okay, whatever.
Yeah, but the with the family dynamic, it's more, it's not about will the family find out and what will they think when they do. It's more about the specific things that Rick is getting up to, how will
yeah.
they judge those? And that's far more interesting.
Yeah.
And it's a choice it sounds like that they made very early on in the process. Like,
yeah.
how aware is the family going to be of what's happening? And they came down on what I think is a perfect note. And John Mayer states it perfectly in that commentary.
Yeah. I wonder if Jerry is some of that vestigial. Because a lot of times he does just react on, you know, mm-hmm. they go, oh, there's a horrifying alien chained up beneath our garage. You know, it's like that's a problem for Jerry, whereas Beth is willing to entertain. Well, maybe he's being cured of some horrible disease or maybe he's a criminal. Like, it's not yeah. like, OK, it's a horrifying alien chained up. Sure. But I need to know the why and the hows before I'm ready to cast judgment.
And maybe, you know, Beth does supply them a shield in that regard, because it's never about like, will Jerry find out, right? Yeah. That's not the tension. It's how will Jerry react to, you know, the alien chained up in the basement?
Yeah, and it's not just inside the family, because what I thought, I think it's Justin that said, this is something that they decided really early on in yep. the writing process of Rick and Morty. It's like, okay, if someone opens up a portal in the high school cafeteria and mm-hmm. like steps through that, that is kind of like riding into the cafeteria on a skateboard, like up, you know, like doing a handstand on a skateboard. There is a way to do that where people will be impressed and delighted and want to know more. And there's a way to do that where you wreck and you kill the lunch lady. And it's a big, horrifying, embarrassing thing. Mm-hmm. And that's how people react to the portal is a flashy, non-standard way to make an entrance into the room. But you can pull it off a style, you can do it lamely, you can yeah. do it in a way that would cause fear and anxiety. And that's, yeah.
And it doesn't disrupt the entire story when it happens.
Right. Like Rick can just land in his garage, but also Rick could come careening down the street like an asshole doing damage to houses, and mm-hmm. the reaction would be completely separate. But I like that. And it's a nice little nuance that I don't think we had probably gotten had John Mayer not showed up to the studio that day.
Yeah, so good for you, John Mayer. One of the other things I want to talk about is the idea that this is a very self-referential episode.
Mm.
And Dan points this out, and he says it's something that he kind of wanted to avoid doing because
right.
of the response in fan communities.
Yeah, everybody's
to,
like, I
want community. To
check out this Rick and Morty cartoon. I'm going to come in on season 3 and see what the fuss is. And like
yeah.
half of it is, what the fuck?
Right.
They're digging up corpses. What? You know?
And there's a lot of just implied knowledge that you should have going into this about, you know, the old family who'd been left in the Cronenberg universe. Yeah, that corpse, like you said, in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's hard to judge this as someone who's seen all the episodes, because mm-hmm. it really works for me. But I think, yeah, if you're somebody new coming into this, might be a little harder to get into this episode.
Well, that's, I think, one of the reasons that, I don't know. It's interesting because I've heard Dan talk about this a lot on the podcast, and he, like, reveres the episodic, not episodic, is it? I always, yeah, but episodic is this one where it's like Golden Girls, Cheers. Like, mm-hmm. they might have a few long-running arcs, but it's basically yeah. you can come into any show, and within, because they use these broad archetypes and situations, You can enjoy episode 3 of season 4 of Cheers as well as you could episode 1, season 1. Probably even more so. Mm-hmm. Because it got better, and he like because it's like a fundamentally harder, like, you know, if you have to do everything within that 23-minute window, and you can't like build big things from it, it's hard, and to do it well and have it be staying power is kind of miraculous, and I think he likes that. But it's also one of those things where it's like it cuts both ways. Yep. Because it's less accessible, but it by definition can't get its hooks sunk as deeply into you because it only has 23 minutes at a time to do it.
Yeah, I think it's less rewarding for long-term fans. I mean, you look at something like one of my all-time favorite shows, Breaking Bad, mm-hmm. and it's real damn hard to jump into that in the middle mm-hmm. because so much of the heavy lifting is done by just how much you know about these characters and the experience you've been through with them. An episode like The Fly doesn't fucking work.
I was
work.
Just thinking, like, if that's your first, if it's like,
oh, God.
Oh, AMC's having a marathon. I've always heard about this. Let me see. What the fuck?
This is trash. They're doing nothing. Why is this entertaining?
They've been hunting a housefly for an hour. What the?
Yeah. And that's one of my favorite episodes because of the baggage. So, like, I understand, you know, the desire. And I think this episode balances both. I think you can enjoy this as a new viewer, but it's so much more rewarding if you're not a new viewer.
The good news, bad news of this commentary is this: how like this is such an excellent premiere, and it's so well broken and so thought through. But because of that, this took them so long and was so stressful that they felt like they were right back in the same situation they were at the end of season two, or the beginning of season two, where it's like, we have used so much time writing this one thing. Mm-hmm. Oh God, what are we going to do? And
Justin was probably climbing the walls to do something crazy.
Yeah.
Like he was in season two. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like that's the thing that I hate hearing, that this is so agonizing and not fun for them to do this amazing thing that we all love.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It's like, it seems like it's maybe a whole new deal with season four, and they've got all this stuff worked out, and I'm curious to see the commentaries for those, because, like, yeah, I just, like, oh man, it makes sense, though. It makes sense that, like, getting this right would take so much time.
I mean, you're setting the foundation for the rest of the season.
Yeah.
Here, you've got to nail this one. You can, you know, you can skimp on episode 2 or 3 or something, but
nail this one. Especially since this episode had to stand on its own for like, what, 4, 5, 6 months? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, people just obsessively rewatch it and rewatch it. And, you know, that's a lot of pressure to put on a single episode. And it kind of held up.
Pickle Me This is distributed by Bald Move in association with Starburns Audio. It's produced by Jason Smith and Scott Porch from Starburns, and myself, Ben Aaron from Bald Move. All music featured on this podcast is from the Rick and Morty soundtrack, available from Sub Pop Records. Please subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. To discover the many other great shows we do, please check out baldmove.com and starburns.audio. If you appreciate what we do and want to directly support us, consider joining our club at club.baldmove.com to get access to exclusive bonus audio and video features. Finally, you can follow us on your favorite social media @BaldMove. See you next time.